לתשומת ליבכם, התוכנית הבאה היא תוכנית מוקלטת, ועשויות להישמע במהלכה התראות והתייחסות לאירועים ביטחוניים שהראו בזמן שידורה הראשון. האזנה טובה.
You are listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening and Shabbat Shalom. This is Mark Weiss with a roundup of the top news at this hour on Friday the 12th of April, on day 189 of the war against Hamas. We open with the high state of alert as Israel braces itself for the possibility of an Iranian strike to avenge the attack on the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus last week, attributed to Israel. The White House said on Friday the reports of an imminent attack by Iran on Israel is a real and viable threat, stressing that the U.S. takes its commitments to defend Israel seriously. White House National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby added that the United States is looking at its own force posture in the region in light of Tehran's threat and is watching the situation very closely. Two American sources told CBS on Friday that an Iranian attack against Israel may take place in the near future and include over 100 drones and dozens of missiles targeted at military sites on Israeli soil. The two sources added, however, that they have not ruled out the possibility that Iran will choose a more limited response in order to avoid a significant escalation. The Wall Street Journal earlier reported that Israel is preparing for a direct attack from Iran in the next 48 hours. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant met with the head of the U.S. Army's CENTCOM Central Command, General Michael Kurila, at an Air Force base on Friday and discussed the preparations for an Iranian attack. The world now understands well who Iran is, the terrorist body that incites terror attacks across the Middle East and funds Hamas, Hezbollah, and additional forces, and now also threatens Israel, Gallant said. We are prepared to defend ourselves on the ground and in the air, in close cooperation with our partners, and we will know how to respond. The IDF and the Mossad have approved offensive operational plans to attack Iran in the event of an attack on Israel that originates from Iranian territory. And there is also collaboration with the American military. Iranian sources told Reuters that the Iranian regime had relayed an indirect message to the White House that Iran would not act hastily or in a manner that would cause an escalation. An American official said Thursday night that the U.S. intelligence reports indicate that Iran's attack may be on Israeli territory and not on Israeli targets abroad. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin called Defense Minister Yoav Gallant last night and reiterated Washington's ironclad commitment to Israel's security against threats from Iran and its proxies. The United States expects an attack by Iran against Israel, but one that would not be big enough to draw Washington into war, a U.S. official said late on Thursday. The White House said earlier Washington did not want conflict to spread in the Middle East, and the U.S. had told Iran it was not involved in an airstrike against a top Iranian military commander in Damascus. The White House said it warned Iran to not use that attack as a pretext to escalate further in the region. The Washington Post reports that Secretary of Defense Austin expressed the Pentagon's frustration to Defense Minister Gallant that the U.S. was not informed in advance of the attack on Damascus last week. We're on a high state of alert and preparedness, IDF spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said, adding that Israel faces danger on all fronts. However, there are no special instructions issued by the IDF's Home Front Command. Hagari said that Israelis would be immediately notified of any steps that needed to be taken. He said a direct attack from Iranian soil would provide clear proof of its intentions to inflame the Middle East and stop hiding behind its proxies. U.S. Secretary of State Blinken has spoken to the foreign ministers of China, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey to argue that further escalation is not in anyone's interest. Blinken asked Beijing to use its influence to dissuade Iran from attacking Israel during a call with his Chinese counterpart. Canada, Australia, and France and India have all issued travel warnings for Israel. The U.S. Embassy in Israel has instructed its staff not to travel outside the Greater Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, or Beersheba areas. German airline Lufthansa has extended a suspension of flights to Tehran until Saturday. There is also tension in the West Bank tonight. One Palestinian was killed and six wounded by gunfire in a Palestinian village near Ramallah during a search for Binyamin Achimeir, a 14-year-old Israeli boy who went missing earlier today from a farm in the Binyamin region. Israeli intelligence officials suspect that he has either been killed or kidnapped, although there is no proof yet. Searches are continuing in the area for him. Israeli military and border police forces surrounded the Ramallah village and carried out searches. Clashes developed with Palestinians, during which stones and Molotov cocktails were thrown at the troops. Three soldiers were injured. That's the news. This is Mark Weiss wishing you Shabbat Shalom from Jerusalem.
You are listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening and Shabbat Shalom. It's Friday, the 12th of April. This is Mark Weiss with a roundup of some of this week's top arts and culture stories. Bezikaron, a startup founded by new immigrants that provides a searchable database for locating grave sites and offers services for tending to them, has launched an initiative for families of those murdered on October the 7th at the Nova Festival to create online memorial pages about their loved ones. Artem Manilov, a co-founder and director of Bezikaron, told reporter Nomi Segel the idea for the initiative came after visiting the Nova Festival exhibition when it was showing at the Tel Aviv Expo.
I and my brothers, we created this company 1.5 years ago. We had a business since 2017 in U.S., and it was the system for cemeteries and crematoriums that do mapping and inventory for cemeteries. And when we moved here to Israel, we decided to try this business to do here in Israel. And we got our first client. It was Ashdod Cemetery. And we did their inventory. And when we did this mapping and inventory, we saw what happens in the cemetery and decided, and the idea came to our mind to create the application Bezikaron to help to people to search their tombstones, headstones, and to create the memorial pages of their beloved ones who gone.
So this is something that people initiate, or that the company calls the information and makes it available?
Yeah, of course. Without the permission of the family, we don't post anything. We just post the open data that we have in the cemeteries. You know, just the photo of the tombstone and the names and dates that we have on the tombstone, and that's it.
And in the wake of the Nova Festival tragedy, you've created a special initiative. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we decided like the first project when we decided to unite the many memorial pages into one group. And it's like the idea to make their own application and their own website where you can find by using any name of the people who passed in this massacre, and just to find the personal information. That now what we are doing now, we are gathering this information from the relatives, what they want to post, the text, some information, some history of this people, their photos and videos. And from this page, you can go directly to the point of our system of inventory. And we will put a very accurate every GPS point on every cemetery in the entire Israel. And anyone who wants to find the headstone or tombstone of these people, just they can find it using this system and just read the every story of every man who were there.
How did you make the connection with the families from the Nova?
We just got acquainted with the people who just organizers of the Nova Festival. We just, when we were invited to this exhibition in Tel Aviv, that was in
at the Expo.
Yes. And we got acquainted with the organizers of this Nova, and we are just spoke to them, and they help us as well to find. It's like volunteers' work that we do, and we think that in the future we can. It's our first experience, but we can do the same memorial pages for not for just the massacres and the disasters like this, and as well for universities, for museums who just want, for example, there were professors in university and they passed away, and we as well can unite it in the one group of people and to do this pages, like memorial pages.
Have you had any feedback from families who are interested in doing these pages?
Yeah. We spoke already, just they want and they pay a lot of attention to select what they want to post there, the information.
And these are private memorial pages or public memorial pages?
It depends. It depends. If the families will give us permission, it would be public. If not, we can change the status, and it will be just a link for the families, and they can share this link among their family, of course, and friends.
Artem Manilov, co-founder of Bezikaron. The October the 7th attacks and ongoing war have challenged Israel's health system in treating both physical injuries and emotional stress. Medical Care, an integrative medicine rehabilitation center located in Bat Yam, is opening a new program whose treatment protocols address both the physical and emotional healing processes. Medical Care Center is managed by the non-profit IMFA, Integrative Medicine for All. Medical Care Rehabilitation Hospital Managing Director Shauli Herzig-Paz told reporter Nomi Segel about how integrative medicine is used for post-trauma treatment.
So first I'll explain about the integrative medicine. You know, most of the conventional hospitals here in Israel and around the world are like big garages. But in those hospitals, the body is the vehicle. We are the vehicle. And every time someone comes to the hospital, we try and mend the physical problem of the body. But nobody speaks to the driver, the patient. So if we have on our hands a reckless driver that keeps on damaging the vehicle, our body, that person would be coming in and out of our hospitals. And every time he would show up with a new physical problem, which is usually created by his own way of life. For example, if he smokes a lot, overweight, a lot of stress, not sleeping, all of this, they create diseases. So the integrative medicine approach is to treat the person which is behind the disease. And how do we do that? How do we treat the person and not just the disease? First of all, we need to strengthen the vitality of the person. The vitality is built through nutrition and exercises and sleep. So if we manage to eat correctly, if we exercise and we sleep better, then we increase our vitality. But it also is created through reducing stress and anxiety, because when we are out of balance and we're under a lot of stress, then that's when we get the stress-related diseases. And how do we do that? Through using psychotherapy treatments and all kinds of treatments like SE focusing that balance the system if it's overstressed. So this is about the integrative medicine, how it's incorporated to...
And why is it considered an effective way in dealing with post-trauma?
So first of all, we have to understand this. This is a most important to use the integrative medicine approach when we deal with people that were injured in a war zone circumstances, because they are under acute stress. They were, for example, a person that was for a few months in Gaza. Say he was in Gaza for 100 days fighting. So he develops conditioned body and conditioned mind responses to danger. He's been through danger zone, so his mind and his body had developed through these 100 days. It's like conditioned behavior. It's like automatic behavior. That means that after 100 days in a war zone, he would be very suspicious. His body would be very aroused. Every small noise or every suspicious movement would activate his stress. Everything would activate his fight and flight response. He's really on the edge. So if he don't deal with this while he's at the hospital, say he was injured and now he's at the hospital, if he won't deal with that, this acute stress response would develop into what we call chronic stress. And from there, it would develop into PTSD. PTSD, that means post-trauma, a trauma that happened to us that creates stress disorder in the body. So the body cannot balance itself anymore. There's a stress disorder. A stress disorder, that means we activate the stress far, far more than we're supposed to. That means we won't sleep, we won't regenerate cells, we would damage our immune system, we would damage our digestion system. A lot of systems in the body would be defaulted because of that. We overstress. We activate the stress because of this. That is the PTSD. So when a person like that is injured, when he comes to the hospital, we need to deal with the physical injury that he was, I don't know if he amputated leg, whatever happened to him, we need to take care of the physical body. But at the same time, we need to start working on balancing this person and bringing him back into normal operational mode. A trauma is an operational mode. It's is in stress disorder. We need to bring him back and balance him. So it is also true, not just for soldiers, it is true for anyone that is under a lot of stress. Like if someone is a mother of a kidnapped person, or someone is a mother of a soldier that is fighting now in Gaza, or someone is not living at home because he was evicted from his home, and he will never know when he will come back home. So all those people, they suffer from elevated stress syndrome. So this part, I also have to say, it really damages the healing process, because if you are under a lot of stress, the healing process, your rehabilitation process is damaged because you are in that stress. So it all comes together. You have to work on those dimensions. You have to work on the physical body, and you have to work on the stress. You have to balance the person and treat him.
Given Israel's familiarity with these kinds of situations, unfortunately, is that a prevalent approach in general in treating trauma and injury? or it's relatively new as in terms of providing such treatments as part of the all-encompassing approach to the individual?
I would say, you know, this is the best ultimate approach. Everybody knows that, and also the Israeli hospitals know that. And in rehabilitation procedures, we all know that a psychologist, a medical psychologist, is very important to be part of the rehabilitation process. This is something that is known and people know it. But because of what happened in this war, we have now almost 6,000 people that were injured. And the amount of the people that they were admitted in the hospital, there was not a lot of time to address those injuries not physically. Physically, everybody addressed the injuries in all the hospitals, but they didn't address their stress, their emotional and stress state of the injured people. So for that exactly, I mean, this is what we are trying now to bring forth. We're trying to, we're not trying, we're opening a program for all those people that were already released from the hospital, but they still need daycare services. They still need to come to the physiotherapy center for the next 5 or 6 months if their injury was severe, to have a continuous physiotherapy on their injury to get better. So what we're doing now, we put up a plan like a daycare service where they would come in the morning. In the morning, they would get the physiotherapy, and in the afternoon they would come and we have an hotel in our hospital. They would sleep over in our hotel, and in the afternoon. And at night, they will get a private sessions for balancing their stress. And at night, they would have like a group therapy with the group of people that are the same circumstances of people that went through the same circumstances. So we can work on their stress and emotional balance, so we can get them back into a normal life and become again functional. Because if we don't deal with that, and if we won't deal with that, and if it would go now, if like for 6 or 7 or 8 months and they won't be treated, then they can even become dysfunctional. They won't be able to work, they won't be able to concentrate, they would develop PTSD syndromes, and it would be very difficult to bring them back once the trauma is crystallized, and PTSD syndrome is the symptoms are very strong. It's hard to rewire them back to balance them back. So it's very, very important to treat them as soon as possible, you know, to get them balanced again.
So this center has opened already, or it is in the planning process?
This is a new daycare program. It's the only daycare program in Israel that incorporates a sleepover and, as I say, dealing with the stress and the PTSD syndromes and balancing the people. And it would open, the program would open by 20th of April, I presume. And we will have group of soldiers and injured people that would come over to continue their daycare service. We have approximately 5,000 people now that were already released from the hospitals, but they need the daycare services for physiotherapy. So they would come over, and we will host them as groups, and we will work with them both physically, emotionally, and mentally to get them back on their feet.
Shauli Herzig Paz, Director General of Medical Care Rehabilitation Hospital, a centre of the non-profit IMFA, Integrative Medicine for All. Now, Ehud Banai with Parparei Haketsev, Beat Butterfly. Thank you.
ברברים בקצב, רוחפים בשמחה ובעצב, מציירים לי תמונה, מכניסים אל התוהו ובוהו תמונה.
ברברים בקצב, רוחפים בשמחה
HaGeffen, the Arab Jewish Culture Center in Haifa, is marking its 60th birthday with a diverse, multidisciplinary program. Among the special events is a new exhibition opening on April the 18th at the Beit HaGeffen Art Gallery, Face, Body, Home. Reporter Nomi Segel heard more from Inna Berkowitz, director and curator of the Beit HaGeffen Art Gallery.
We are speaking against the backdrop of the upcoming opening of a new exhibition at the Beit HaGeffen Gallery. But first, it's part of the 60th anniversary events of Beit HaGeffen. First, let's talk a little bit about this cultural institution for perhaps listeners who don't know, which is very unique in the Israeli cultural scene.
Yes, it is in fact very special. It's an Arab-Jewish cultural center in Haifa that was opened in 1963. So we've been in existence for a very long time, and what we do is we try to promote this idea of a multicultural society through culture and art.
This is certainly something that's very important and can also be very challenging at times.
It is challenging. It has been challenging throughout the existence of our center, and it is especially challenging right now. But I think that's what makes it so important, that we continue this conversation between the different people that live here, and with this idea that if we talk to each other, then we can live better with each other and with the different views that we have here in Israel.
How is Beit HaGefen marking this milestone?
So during the month of April, we're having several cultural events. We had a huge concert with the Revolution Orchestra just a few days ago, and we have many concerts and plays that are going on through this month, and we're opening a new exhibition at the gallery as well.
So let's talk about that, as you are curator of this gallery and this exhibition.
Yeah, sure. So it's a very diverse exhibition. It's called Face, Body, Home. And there are four artists that show in this exhibition. Irina Karkabi, a very seasoned, very talented painter. Ayman Dao, who's a fashion designer and also an artist. And two performers, Dua Psis and Saeed Mansour, who will be performing a new performance at the gallery at the opening night.
And how do all of these elements interplay?
Well, I think I just want to say that nothing that we do the 7th of October is really planned. So we're trying to adapt to a new reality. So there was supposed to be a different exhibition at the gallery, but we decided to change course a little bit. And I think this exhibition is really going back to the basic needs of us as people. So a need to see a human face, a friendly face, to have a human connection and to feel at home. And I think that the different works that are on display at the exhibition really touch on different aspects of those themes.
There's an interplay there as well.
Well, yes. So the artists all work in very different disciplines. So the Irina Karkabi is showing an exhibition of portraits. And these are friends and family and intellectuals from Haifa. And you are just walking into a room of faces. And she is really good at making that connection with the people that she paints. And you really feel like you stare into the eyes of these people and you are getting to know these people. And Ayman Dao is showing an installation that is part of the house itself, the gallery itself. He's kind of peeling off the different layers of this house that the gallery is located in, which was built during the Ottoman Empire. So there are many layers. And he started working on this work before the 7th of October and continued working after, and kind of the focus shifted, and from this celebratory work it turned into this beacon of light and hope that helped him through this hard time. And the performance that was planned especially for the gallery is really two people, a couple. They're not a couple in real life, but they're making this connection through fabric and through movement, and they talk about all these little moments that a human connection can be made or missed.
So it's about human connection. You mentioned the faces, the various faces who appear in the portrait, and also adjusting the exhibition post October 7th. Were the paintings still intended, or it was thinking about the images that were being chosen, the works that were chosen for it?
We're really showing a body of work that Irina has been working on for over 30 years. And I have to say that even though we're adapting to this very harsh reality, what we do here is not really new. So she's been working on depicting the different types of people that live in Haifa and this tapestry of characters and cultures that exists in Haifa. And it's very relevant to our situation today.
The gallery is very much, as you mentioned, of Haifa as well.
I think Haifa is a very unique city in Israel. And I think there is this, you can say the word coexistence. I think it's not ideal by any means, but we do see a more diverse society in Haifa than I think in other cities in Israel. I think that the different cultures in Haifa have a more have more of a voice. So I think the Beit HaGeffen is just kind of like this little capsule of that.
And going back to Irina's works, it's an intimate experience then for the artist, but also for the viewer, perhaps.
I think, yeah, I think it's very intimate. And I think what we're showing also for the first time are sketches that she made when she was 15 years old. And you can see how talented she was at 15, but you can also see she painted her grandmother, her father, her mother, her little brother. So you're really getting to see her family, get to see her partner, her children, all her family. So you are really walking into Irina's home, in a way.
Very much a retrospective on her own life and also her development as an artist.
Yes, definitely. And you can really see how she perfected her craft over the years, and she really reached a level of craftsmanship that is masterful. And you don't see that very often in the art world today.
And is there a sense as well of her own life experiences in the way that she portrays individuals, depending on when they were painted during her career?
Definitely, yes. I think it's a very intimate experience to paint someone. So a connection is made, even if the person that you are painting is not someone that you know very well. So there are little stories that go with every portrait that you can read at the exhibition. And I think, yeah, it shows her life experiences. I think it shows her experience as an immigrant here in Israel who came here from Russia. And I think it shows a little bit that sense of not having roots. And I think some of the connections that she made with the people that she painted are also people that don't have roots and are searching for a home and a connection.
Very much in line with the title of this exhibition. So when and where can it be seen?
So we are opening on the 18th of April at 7 o'clock. And the exhibition will be shown throughout the next month until the 9th of August.
Ina Berkowitz, director and curator of a gallery at Beit HaGeffen, located at 2 HaGeffen Street in Haifa. Now, 100 Israeli artists at the Caesarea Amphitheatre with Habaita, Coming Home.
Thank you.
Israel's most famous historian, Yuval Noah Harari, has written a new children's book called Unstoppable Us, Volume 2, Why the World Isn't Fair, focusing on the power of stories. In front of a live audience at New York's 92nd Street Y, he spoke with author Ian Bremner about the new book.
The thing that I took away most directly when you're writing for kids about why life isn't fair, is you're saying it's basically, it's all about stories.
Yeah.
Explain what you mean by that.
Much of it is about stories. Yeah, that, you know, since I was a kid, I was extremely concerned, especially about the issue of war. I live in Israel, I live in the Middle East, there is constantly war. And you want to know why there are so many wars in the world. And many people tell you that people fight, humans fight, for the same reasons that other animals fight. It's just natural. You fight over territory, you fight over food, the same way that chimpanzees and wolves and lions fight. And it took me many years of researching history to understand this is just not true. Humans don't fight over territory and food. They fight over imaginary stories in their minds. If I look at the present terrible conflict tearing apart my region of the world, it's not really about territory, not objectively. There is enough land between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River to build houses and schools and hospitals for everybody. There is no objective shortage of land. And similarly, there is no objective shortage of food. There is enough food to feed everybody. And this is true of other conflicts in the world. You look at the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russia doesn't lack territory. The last thing they need is more land. And so why do they fight? People fight over the stories in their mind. Like I work in Jerusalem in the Hebrew University. And you know, it's one of the most fought over places in human history. It's hard to understand why. It's not such a great place. You know, I mean, it's a very ordinary place. You walk around, it's just, you know, you have stones and trees and cats and pigeons and people, just like any other place.
I mean, it's on the water, the land is pretty good.
The land is not good. You can grow olives or something. There are no oil fields. There are no gold mines. Nothing. But in their imagination, people think, oh, this is not a stone. This is a holy stone. This is not just any place. It's full of angels and gods and saints and prophets. And they fight over this. You know, my husband just went 2 days ago here to the Apple store and bought these new Apple glasses.
You let him do that? Seriously? It's the beginning of the end of your relationship, obviously.
Well, that's one prediction that we'll see what will happen with it. But, you know, people invented it thousands of years ago, this technology. Yeah, like they just call it a different name. It's the Holy Book. Like you walk around Jerusalem with this holy book and you see it's full of the augmented reality of angels and gods. And this is what people fight over. I just read a couple of weeks ago a book that Sari Nusseibeh, a Palestinian philosopher, wrote a couple of years ago. And he said that, you know, in context of the fight over Temple Mount, and the Dome of the Rock, and the Holy Rock, on the Dome of the Rock, under the Dome of the Rock. And he wrote that Jews and Muslims, armed with nuclear weapons, are about to commit one of the worst massacres of human beings ever over a rock. Over a rock. And it's absolutely true. I listened to our Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he says this is the Selakiumenu, the rock of our existence. And, of course, the rock is just a rock. But the stories that we tell about it make it so important that people are willing to be killed, to kill and be killed in millions.
So structurally, what upsets you more, nationalism or religion?
I think, first of all, we need both. In order to construct large-scale human societies, you must have these stories. They are not necessarily bad. Stories are tools. You know, it's like a knife, that you can use the knife to murder somebody or to save their life in surgery or to cut salad for dinner.
And they create order in large societies.
So without religion, without nationalism, we can talk later, for instance, about the link between nationalism and democracy. I think that there are exceptions, but in most cases, nationalism is a precondition for democracy. If you don't have a strong national community, you cannot have a functioning democratic system. Every state is made up of many different tribes. If you don't have strong patriotic national feelings that unite the tribes, you cannot have a democracy, because every tribe will just fight for its own interests without caring at all. And you can have a democracy, a dictatorship under such conditions, but not a democracy. And again, like with every story...
And is religion a precondition for anything on the positive side?
I don't think it's a precondition, let's say, for democracy, but it has done throughout history a lot of good as well as a lot of bad things. And the question is, what do we do with these stories? Like with nationalism, you have the good side of nationalism is when it's about love. That the essence of nationalism should be a feeling of love, of a special care about a group of people that makes me, for instance, you know, pay my taxes honestly so that people that I never met in my life will get healthcare. This is the bright side of nationalism. The dark side is when it turns from love to hate, when people think that to be a patriot means to hate foreigners or minorities or whatever. And it's the same with religion. Religion doesn't come down from heaven. It's created by humans. You look at the history of every religion, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism. People can make terrible things out of it, and they can make good things out of it. It's in our hands.
Israeli historian Yuval Noah Harari. Thanks for listening. This is Mark Weiss wishing you Shabbat Shalom from Jerusalem.
כי ראיתי את דרכי נעלמת ביער סבוך בין קירות חורשים ובתוך האדמה המדממת רגליי ננעצו היכו שורשים מתחתיי והרוח קרה ונואשת הקפיאה אותי הכבידה עליי עצמתי עיניי, אטמתי ליבי והרגשתי איך אני מתפרקת מכל כאביי, מכל פתידותי
please take me to that place again. Take me where stiff becomes velvet, our clothes are soaking wet. Please take me to that place again, the place we all know.
I'm dancing myself in, I'm glancing at the storm of the pure.